2007, Condoleezza Rice hired Elliot Cohen to become her counselor at state. He was a Harvard-educated political scientist who favored bow ties. Rice asked him to spend as much time in the field as possible to offer independent assessments. He found in Afghanistan that there was a pattern of briefings at military headquarters, whether at Kabul or in the regions. The commanders starting a rotation would say, "This is going to be difficult." 6 months later, they'd say, "We might be turning a corner." At the end of their rotation, they would say, "We have achieved irreversible momentum." Then the next command group coming in would pronounce, "This is going to be difficult." At the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, State Department reporting seemed to some of Rice's advisors to have become detached from reality. Bill Wood, the ambassador, was more optimistic than her senior analysts. David Gordon, a political scientist who served as Rice's director of policy planning, considered Wood a solid citizen, but noted that he was of the view that things were becoming stabilized when the evidence was hard to find. Elliot Cohen commissioned memos objecting to an oft-quoted claim, usually emanating from ISAF commanders, asserting that more than 75% of the war's violence occurred in just 10% of Afghan districts, mainly in Helmand and Kandahar. He didn't think the United States knew enough about what was happening in all of Afghanistan's 398 districts to be so precise. The CIA district assessments purported to let numbers tell the war's story, coldly, but it did not require access to secret information to see the trends. Early on after his arrival at state, before the district assessments became popular, Cohen used unclassified United Nations maps dating back to 2002 to try to shock Rice and other principals into recognition of how badly Afghanistan was deteriorating. The UN maps depicted Afghan districts as green if they were safe for aid workers. On the CIA maps, green depicted government control, but did not necessarily indicate that the area was safe for international travelers. Cohen unfurled annual maps that showed Afghanistan's green zone was shrinking fast. The indicators reflected on the CIA maps came from all sources, including military field reports, CIA agent reporting, diplomatic reporting, allied governments, the United Nations, and published journalism. The CIA took final responsibility for each district's rating, but the team's analysts solicited data and dissents from other intelligence agencies. There were reasons for competing analysts to be skeptical. Paul Miller, the former CIA analyst who moved to the National Security Council to work on Afghanistan just as the maps were being produced, noted that the color-coded scheme didn't have a category for unknown. He thought the agency didn't own up to its intelligence gaps. He would have guessed that a large portion of the map should have been painted as unknown. The officers who produced the maps heard this criticism regularly. They argued that it was misplaced because as troop and civilian deployments to Afghanistan rose after 2007, the United States had more reach in its field reporting than at any time since the Taliban's fall. The district assessments had an antecedent in the Vietnam War, a project known as the Hamlet Evaluation System, undertaken by the Pentagon starting in 1967. Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support, or CORDS, oversaw that work. American provincial and district advisors working on the pacification campaign for CORDS filled out monthly questionnaires about all the hamlets in their areas, grading security indicators on a scale of A, most aligned with the South Vietnamese government, to E, heavily influenced by the Viet Cong, to V, totally under Viet Cong control. Later, they also tried to measure development and governance indicators such as healthcare and education. The problem was that it was unrealistic to expect the Americans, mainly military officers, who were scattered around violent sections of South Vietnam, to accurately collect such metrics. One issue was that, "You know what your boss wants to hear, that we were winning the war. As Ron Milam, an advisor who worked on the project, put it, "To make the scores look better, hamlets under Viet Cong control were sometimes removed from the calculations or blended with hamlets with better scores to make the picture look more encouraging." As part of the Pentagon's effort to convince the American public that the Vietnam War was going well, U.S. briefers created sanitized, unclassified versions of maps derived from the hamlet evaluation system. They used them in Saigon to impress visiting members of Congress, European ambassadors, newspaper columnists, and other opinion makers. The maps became a symbol of the inclination of successive administrations in Washington to manipulate information about the war for political advantage, as the historian David Elliott put it. The CIA analysts who worked on the district assessments 40 years later were post-Vietnam skeptics well aware of that history of delusion and public dishonesty. If anything, in the judgment of Pentagon commanders and some White House aides, the CIA analysts were inclined toward overwrought pessimism about the war in Afghanistan and the deterioration of Pakistan after 2007. In any event, the CIA maps showed starkly that the Taliban were marching toward control or the ability to contest control of about half of the country, district by district. They did not provide a basis for official optimism. That did not prevent generals in Kabul from being optimistic. During a 2007 secure video conference with General Dan McNeil, then top American commander in Afghanistan, Robert Gates, Rumsfeld's recently arrived successor as Secretary of Defense, asked, "Dan, I'm trying to get a sense if we are making progress. Are we making gains in quelling the insurgency? If we are winning, by what measure?" McNeil defended the war effort. Since arriving in Afghanistan, he had repeatedly heard dark forecasts about the war's deterioration from CIA analysts and others at State and DIA. He thought the pessimists were overstating the evidence. The general's take was that the war effort in the South had almost collapsed late in 2006, but that fight back by the Canadians and more aggressive tactics by NATO overall had stabilized the situation. Fundamentally, McNeil argued, the war hadn't changed. They had to be patient. Privately, McNeil figured it would take up to 2 decades to put Afghan forces in a position where they could defend the country adequately on their own. When the general signed off, Gates turned to his aides, incredulous. As a former director of analysis of the CIA, he knew a thing or two about taking the agency with a grain of salt, he told them. Yet the CIA analysts' assessments that the situation is dramatically declining doesn't comport with what I'm hearing from McNeil or the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. My sense is that we are not getting this right and that the situation is going sideways on us. The CIA maps revived a dilemma familiar from Vietnam. Could verifiable facts about a deteriorating war lead policymakers to understand the futility of the country's policies? Throughout 2007, the U.S. government's classified information systems were replete with candid reports about rising violence in Afghanistan and failing governance by the Karzai administration. The problem was not a paucity of information. It was Washington's ability to recognize the pattern. Provincial reconstruction teams scattered around Afghanistan regularly sent to Washington lengthy written assessments, drawing on their access to local conditions. The PRT report from Kandahar, the Taliban's birthplace, was particularly bleak. The Canadian military offensive late in 2006 had raised the local population's expectations, but NATO's failure to consolidate victory had proven to be costly. The inability of the United States to crack down on the Taliban's sanctuaries in Pakistan had given rise to conspiracy thinking among Kandaharis. American passivity toward Pakistan was interpreted as proof of a plot to prolong instability in Afghanistan, or in the most extreme version, proof of a secret alliance between the West and the Taliban. The major political challenge is the lack of good governance, the report warned. Exploitative since 2002, the Karzai regime was sinking into systematic racketeering across the South. Real power is wielded by a select few, and standard practices would be considered corrupt in the West. Ahmed Wali Karzai, brother of President Karzai, exercises far more power than his position as head of the Advisory Provincial Council should convey. 50,000 students were forced out of schools by violence during 2006, and virtually all schools in the province had by now closed. The rise of suicide bombing attacks against rolling convoys had caused American and NATO forces to ease their rules of engagement so that they now fired rounds into vehicles suspected of an attack. Inevitably, the snap judgments of exposed soldiers on the front lines led to mistakes and innocent deaths. These deaths, while not easy to avoid, do much to undermine our credibility with the population. Corruption by police and government officials is having a corrosive impact on government credibility while boosting that of the Taliban, noted a separate report from the U.S. Embassy in Kabul that summer about Kandahar. Despite the killing of hundreds of Taliban volunteers, insurgents have increased their presence in many districts. The Taliban struck soft targets, such as the Afghan police, a force that was very weak, poorly controlled, and virtually unsupported by NATO or the United States. Afghan police earned just $70 per month in Kandahar for work that was high risk and low reward. Taliban night letters and assassinations intimidated villagers, farmers, and mullahs preaching publicly about the war. They increasingly adopted a stance of neutrality to avoid death, and if they happened to work for Canada or the United Nations, they hid such information from their neighbors. There were also strong indications that some district leaders and chiefs of police are engaged in supporting the trafficking of narcotics, the U.S. Embassy in Kabul reported. These same officials have extracted bribes from farmers to keep them off the list of fields to be targeted under the governor-led eradication program. There were also strong indications that Abdul Razik, the local ruler and prized American ally in Spin Boldak, on the road to Quetta, controls large-scale narcotics trafficking. Graham Smith, the Canadian journalist who lived in Kandahar during this period, worked with Afghan colleagues to conduct an informal survey of Taliban fighters in the region. 37 of the 42 Taliban they reached belonged to tribes that had lost out during the reigns of the Karzais and Gul Aga Sherzai. These Taliban also had only the thinnest understanding of their international enemies. They did tend to grasp that the United States was a world power, a direct equivalent of past empires that sent crusaders to the Middle East. Canada puzzled them, however. Some did not even understand that it was a country. "It might be an old and destroyed city," one respondent said. This was not an aspect of the war's asymmetries that could be coded easily onto a data map. Regular travel to Afghanistan and Pakistan, sometimes in bow tie and flak jacket, left Elliot Cohen with the impression that Rice and Bush were getting an awful lot of happy talk from people who should know better. The Afghan war might be better than Iraq, but there were many indicators that things were not well. On one of his field surveys, Cohen flew with a colonel over a contested Afghan valley. "Tell me the mechanics of this war," Cohen asked. "Clear the valley," the colonel replied. "What do you mean?" "You walk through a valley until you get into a firefight, and then you keep shooting until it stops." "That's a little troubling," Cohen said. "It's a valley-by-valley war, sir." Between 2002 and 2006, the CIA's operations in Afghanistan had concentrated largely on the secret Afghan militias built up by the Omega teams along the Pakistan border to hunt for al-Qaeda members. Cooperation with Karzai and a few key governors, such as Sherzai and Asadullah Khalid, and support for the NDS. The demands of the Iraq War, instability on the seventh floor at Langley, and short tours by Kabul station chiefs of erratic quality limited the agency's effectiveness. In 2007, as the Bush administration authorized much larger budgets for aid for Afghanistan, the CIA's engagement expanded. The agency's financial support for NDS increased. The agency operated about a dozen bases outside of Kabul Station and commanded a private air force of planes and helicopters. Its two main priorities remained locating al-Qaeda cells operating across the border in Pakistan's tribal areas and the hunt for senior al-Qaeda leaders, particularly bin Laden and Zawahiri. It was baffling, and not an advertisement for CIA capabilities and focus, that they remained at large. Yet the agency was now drawn increasingly into the conflicts against the Taliban as well. The American military and espionage machine, hardened by 4 years of brutal combat in Iraq, could find it difficult to share space with European counterparts in Afghanistan. An American two-star officer deployed to the ISAF headquarters in Kabul in 2007 found a typical NATO billet, appalling in many ways. Officers worked from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and then retired to the pub. At night, half the command was drunk. He kept waiting for an attack to penetrate the grounds. Yet the Bush administration had sold Canada and European governments on the Afghan mission on the premise that it would resemble peacekeeping, not all-out combat. Early in February 2008, Condoleezza Rice flew to London to discuss the Afghan war with her counterpart, David Miliband, as well as other British analysts. The Foreign Office organized the seminar. It sometimes contributed to the Bush administration by functioning as a kind of think tank, generating classified white papers and hosting crisp meetings where British experts presented their analyses. To influence the Bush administration, they had to offer ideas within the scope of what the Americans would accept, and yet ideas that were fresh and interesting enough to warrant attention. In the case of Afghanistan, British experts emphasized the importance of political and development strategy in Afghanistan to complement military operations. But what kind of political strategy would defeat or co-opt or at least slow down the Taliban? Rice and other key figures in the Bush administration had reached a heightened state of enthusiasm about counterinsurgency doctrine as advocated for by General David Petraeus. He had commanded Bush's risk-taking surge of fresh American troops into Baghdad in 2007, and by early 2008 the effort was showing success. Elliot Cohen, Rice's influential new counselor, had worked with Petraeus on counterinsurgency doctrine. Rice came to London, very focused on roads and economy and policing for Afghanistan, staples of Petraeus's approach to quelling insurgents. The British were groping for an alternative to counterinsurgency theory for Afghanistan, a more sophisticated political strategy, but were not yet prepared to recommend a radical change of course, such as negotiating with the Taliban directly. In London, they agreed privately on a plan to promote a modest intensification of current policy, while publicly committing to stay the course to show resolve. There were now about 55,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan from 39 countries, four-fifths of them under NATO command. The rest were American troops that operated independently on counterterrorism missions. Rice and Miliband agreed that the United States and Britain would call on NATO to find 1,000 more troops to support the fight against the Taliban in southern Afghanistan, while the United States would rotate about 3,200 more Marines into the country later that year. The Iraq War meant the United States had no more troops to offer, and squeezing even 1,000 soldiers out of European governments looked difficult. On February 7th, Rice and Miliband flew together into Kabul. Hamid Karzai took Miliband to point out a hill in the capital where British troops had fought in their second unsuccessful war in Afghanistan during the 19th century. Karzai mentioned that his presidential palace had been built on the site of a British camp. He seemed increasingly to enjoy reflecting on the history of Western failures in his country. He remained an Anglophile, suspicious of British motives, particularly its supposed favoritism toward Pakistan. "Either you know what's going on, or your people aren't telling you what they're doing," he told Miliband. When Rice tried to speak up for Britain, Karzai would have none of it. "America doesn't have anything to do with this treachery," he said. Rice was stunned. Karzai complained as well about rising civilian casualties caused by the heavy fighting and aerial bombardment in Kandahar and Helmand. This was a complaint Karzai had been voicing regularly to American and British visitors for more than a year, with rising dismay. Bill Wood and his British counterpart in Kabul, Sherrod Cooper Coles, both sympathized with Karzai and thought he was essentially correct about the problem of civilian casualties, even if there was little to be done, as the Taliban had to be challenged militarily. But visitors from London and Washington came away with an increasingly bitter taste, receiving Karzai's dissents as ingratitude. With Wood and Cooper Coles, Rice and Miliband flew to Kandahar. "This isn't a kind of blinding flash of success," Rice told reporters, assessing the war. "What you have is milestones along the way that you try to reach." At Kandahar Airfield, she thanked a multinational audience of soldiers, assuring them, "You are contributing not only to the security and future of the Afghan people, but to the security and the future of your own countries, your own people, and indeed, the security and the future of the world." In private, she was more skeptical. "We are winning, Madam Secretary, but it doesn't feel like it," Wood said at one point during a session with American briefers. "Mr. Ambassador," Rice replied, "in counterinsurgency, if it doesn't seem like you're winning, you're not winning," she added. "This war isn't working." 2 weeks after Rice departed, Senators Joe Biden, John Kerry, and Chuck Hagel flew into Kabul. They were friends, bound by long years in the Senate and on its Foreign Relations Committee. Biden then chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His campaign to win the Democratic Party's nomination for the presidency had just ended, leaving two other Senate colleagues, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, to slog it out. Major General David Rodriguez, commanding 82nd Airborne Units in eastern Afghanistan, escorted the three senators on a helicopter tour of his command sector. They flew in an armed Black Hawk with their staff trailing in a second helicopter. They visited soldiers at a forward operating base in Kunar province. On the flight back to Bagram, Rodriguez pointed out the window at the snowy, cragged peaks and said that Tora Bora was just a few miles away. They decided to fly over to take a look. By now, Hagel and Kerry were flying together in the lead helicopter, and Biden was in the one behind them. Hagel, who had also served in Vietnam, where he was twice wounded, doubted the wisdom of the Tora Bora tour. "Christ, we've got blizzards coming up. We're running low on fuel. I don't think you should do it." As committee chair, Biden led the delegation. "Let's do it, but quick," he decided. The snow squall around them intensified, and they couldn't see a thing. The pilot banked suddenly, jockeying in a fierce wind. Over his headset, Biden heard that his helicopter's pilot had lost sight of the Black Hawk in front of them and believed it had gone down. They shortly discovered that it had successfully made an emergency landing on a high ridge above Bagram. They ended up stranded in the snow for hours, watching unknown armed men watching them from a nearby ridge. Soldiers escorting them set up perimeter defenses on both ends of the ridge, and they took turns warming up outside by standing in front of the helicopter's air exhaust. They hadn't dressed for the cold. ISAF ordered F-16s above them, flying circles. Finally, they hiked about a mile to the far end of the ridge, where a military convoy arrived to take them down to Bagram in pre-dawn darkness. They joined Karzai for dinner at the Arg that night. As he had been with Miliband, the Afghan president was in a foul mood. Biden sat directly across from him, next to Hagel. Karzai started popping off, saying the United States didn't care about Afghanistan. He rankled all three senators. Biden started talking back. He was getting very pissed off. Hagel tried to catch Biden's eye and gestured to suggest that he lower the temperature. Biden ignored him. "Your country hasn't done anything to help Afghanistan," Karzai continued. Biden slammed his hand down on the table so hard that every plate jumped and rattled. Then he jolted back from his chair and declared, "This conversation, this dinner, is over." He stormed out of the dining room. Hagel and Kerry followed Biden, but Kerry, who was farthest from the door, hung back a bit. He pulled Karzai aside. He told him that he had to understand that Biden had a son about to deploy to Afghanistan, that this was very personal to him. "All three of us believe in the alliance with Afghanistan," Kerry went on. "But those kinds of comments about the United States serve no one's interests." Karzai expressed appreciation. It was the beginning of what would become Kerry's run as America's Karzai Whisperer. The work was about to get much harder. Chapter 18. Tough Love. On July 7th, 2008, in Kabul, just after 8 a.m., a 22-year-old Pakistani named Hamza Shakur steered a Toyota Camry through the morning rush. Near the Interior Ministry, he fell in behind two cars with Indian diplomatic plates. They inched toward the iron gates of the Indian embassy. Scores of civilians stood in line along the compound walls, waiting to apply for visas. Shakur detonated 200 pounds of explosives. The blast could be heard miles away. 58 people died, including the bomber and Brigadier Ravi Dutt Mehta, the Indian defense attaché in Afghanistan. Afghan NDS investigations into Shakur's history, as well as U.S. National Security Agency intercepts, appeared to show that ISI officers had coordinated the attack on the Indian embassy in Kabul by working with commanders of the Haqqani network in North Waziristan. The Haqqanis had inserted the bomber and his vehicle into the Afghan capital. Shakur had also been trained by Lashkar-e-Taiba, the ISI-managed insurgent force in Kashmir. The investigation was still developing, but American, British, and other allied intelligence services would eventually conclude that a special Haqqani unit had carried out the attack under ISI orders to hit hostile targets in Afghanistan, including Indian ones. ISI officers knew they were under surveillance, so limited their direct involvement with daily operations, but the intelligence analysis held that they were fully culpable nonetheless. The strike was effectively an act of guerrilla war by the Pakistan Army against the Indian military. The Indian bombing infuriated Bush. To that point, no single attack had more hardened the president's attitude against the ISI. The intelligence case against ISI had shifted from ambiguous and debated to definitive. The embassy attack provided one dossier of evidence, but there were others accumulating against ISI that spring as well. The National Security Council met in the Situation Room on July 11th and reviewed the matter. Bush dispatched Deputy CIA Director Kappis and Admiral Mike Mullen, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to challenge Ashfaq Kayani, now the Army Chief. Among other things, they were to demand concrete reform at the Pakistani spy service. Kappis flew into Islamabad aboard an Air Force transport 5 days after the attack. By now, Kappis and CIA Director Mike Hayden all but operated a secret shuttle service to Pakistan, flying stretched out in the back of C-17s on overnight routes, hauling briefing books so thick they could serve as ballast. Typically, Kappis spent time with Kayani alone, one-on-one. The reception party awaiting him included Frank Archibald, now the Islamabad station chief. Archibald was the veteran operations officer who had tried, while serving in Kandahar during 2002, to convert remnant Taliban into a Karzai-tolerant political party, only to have his plan overruled by Washington. 6 years later, The CIA was still puzzling over how to contain the ISI's influence inside Afghanistan. Kappus was best known at Langley and at the White House for his service at Moscow Station and for his role in negotiating Libya's surrender of its nuclear and chemical weapons programs during the first Bush term. His connections to Pakistan were less well known. Early in his career, after 5 years in the Marine Corps, Kappus had served as a CIA case officer in the country, reporting on politics at a time when it was possible to travel freely. His son had arrived in Pakistan at the age of 5 weeks and spent his early years there. Kappus had also served in India, reveling as a young operations officer in the openness and occasional hilarity of expatriate life in the subcontinent. Now in his 50s, he was bald, bespectacled, and wore a cropped salt-and-pepper beard. He remained fit and muscled, although in late middle age, his large shoulders had expanded above his narrow midsection, making him appear slightly misshaped in the manner of a tall, retired football player. At the meeting, Kayani smoked from his long-stemmed holder. He did not admit to culpability for the deaths in Kabul, but neither did he deny communication with Haqqani commanders. He was reticent, professional, a listener, but his method was to never really say yes and never really say no. You see, any intelligence agency, if they're going to do their job, you have to have contacts, Kayani said. Every intelligence agency has contacts. The CIA has contacts. The ISI has contacts. If I tell the ISI not to have contacts, they will be blind. Contacts are maintained with the worst of the lot. It's a compulsion of intelligence that you will have contacts with the worst kind of people. But the question is, how do you use these contacts? Do you use them positively or negatively? ISI's leadership that summer of 2008 was in disarray. The ISI officer in direct charge of Directorate S was Major General Asif Akhtar. He reported to the spy service's Director General, Nadeem Taj, who in turn reported to Kayani. Yet Taj had not been Kayani's choice for the job. It was an awkward fit. Taj was a general notable mainly for his personal loyalties to Musharraf, now out of power. He had worked as a military secretary with Musharraf during the period when the president faced assassination attempts. The Americans didn't think much of him. He immersed himself in political machinations, the embassy reported, and never seemed comfortable in his role as intelligence chief and was reluctant to engage with his U.S. counterparts. A senior American officer who worked with Taj and read sensitive intelligence about him that year put it more directly. He was just a bagman for Musharraf, a guy nobody trusted. That presumably included Kayani, who owed his power to Musharraf, but now had to free himself from his mentor's influence and promote his own lieutenants inside ISI. Kappus flew home. The Principal's Committee and then the National Security Council met in late July. They had before them new CIA plans to address Waziristan. Hayden and Mike DeAndrea at the agency's Counterterrorism Center proposed to ramp up Predator and Reaper drone attacks and other intelligence collection in the tribal areas. The plan called for an end to the practice of seeking concurrence from ISI about suspected terrorists targeted for death in drone attacks. The CIA also sought to loosen top-secret targeting rules for its operations by introducing, for the first time, practices that would become known as signature strikes, meaning that a suspected militant might be killed even if his identity was unknown, as long as his observed behavior showed threatening hostility. They also expanded the target list to include more al-Qaeda as well as the Taliban and Haqqani leadership. Altogether, the CIA plans marked a departure from the consultation and restraint that had governed the agency's drone operations in Pakistan after 2002. Since the killing of Nek Mohammed in June 2004, The CIA had conducted only 14 lethal drone attacks in Pakistan's tribal areas over 4 years. Hayden argued that escalation and the new targeting rules would shorten the time required to strike a fleeting, dangerous target. An Al-Qaeda bomb maker with a confirmed cell phone riding away from Miranshah, for example. The changes would also prevent ISI from warning targets. The CIA and the Pentagon also proposed expanding authorities for U.S. Special Operations and Omega Team forces to raid compounds inside Pakistan from bases in Afghanistan. In Kabul, Greg Vogel arrived as CIA station chief to try to solve America's fraying relationship with Karzai, drawing on their battlefield comradeship during late 2001, and to improve coordination between the CIA and McChrystal's special operators. Vogel supported more aggressive ground raids into Waziristan. After the next attack, knowing what we know now, there's no explaining it if we don't do something, Hayden argued at the White House. Bush heard as well from Pentagon officers who had recently served in Afghanistan as waves of Taliban fighters crossed from Waziristan to attack American troops. Mick Nicholson, then a brigadier general running the Afghanistan-Pakistan cell at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had recently returned from a tour in eastern Afghanistan where his forces had suffered 35 killed in action and another 30 wounded because of the Haqqanis, he told colleagues. We're going to stop playing the game, Bush declared. These sons of bitches are killing Americans. I've had enough. Yet even at this turning point, the Bush administration did not wish to break with the Pakistan Army. In essence, the National Security Council decided to confront General Kayani as he took control of the army, and yet, simultaneously, to embrace him more closely, with aid and closer consultation. A major reason was Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. The administration had regular reports of Al-Qaeda and other groups plotting to steal nuclear weapons. They did not want to do anything that would destabilize Pakistani command and control. As Michael Waltz, an aide to Vice President Cheney, put it, if we began to retaliate for Pakistan's support of the Taliban, how far were we prepared to go? Could we really afford to make Pakistan an enemy? Were we prepared to fight the Pakistani army's tanks and artillery on the way in and out? Were we prepared to shoot down its air force, planes the United States had supplied? Whenever the cabinet contemplated such dark scenarios, it backed away. And it was plain that the Pakistan army was in trouble that summer. Domestic insurgents had seized Swat, a mountainous district about 150 miles to the northwest of Islamabad, and now threatened the Pakistani capital. The Pakistan army fought back strongly and seemed to gradually contain the threat. Yet the durability of this military achievement, Pakistanis fighting Pakistanis for the most part, was questionable. The Americans wanted to reinforce the tentative progress the army had made in Swat. Kayani had been in charge of the military for less than a year. He had enough history with the United States, at Fort Leavenworth, in Hawaii, on base tours, and line-skipping through Disneyland with Dave Smith, to be seen as a potentially constructive partner. Steve Kappas and Peter Lavoy, the administration's two most senior intelligence experts on Pakistan, advocated for engagement. After such a long career in CIA espionage operations, Kappas had developed an operating philosophy about challenges such as Directorate S. All national security services were loyal to their own sovereign governments, he reminded CIA colleagues and the National Security Council. ISI represented itself, the Pakistan Army, and, to a lesser extent, the civilian-led Pakistani state. One American ambassador and CIA station chief after another had tried across many years to persuade ISI that it did not need the Taliban to influence Afghanistan and that it did not require militant Islamists in Kashmir to pressure India. Yet those entreaties had failed. The situation now called for realism. The ISI was not motivated to challenge America's enemies in the tribal areas. That justified more drone strikes. It did not imply that it would be wise to sanction Kayani or ISI, or that such pressure would succeed, this line of thinking went. The expiring Bush administration was divided between those who saw Pakistan as totally lost, as the State Department's David Gordon put it, and those who had the view that they're complicit, but there's a chance this could turn out better. Sanctions imposed by the United States on Pakistan during the 1990s had had limited American influence as the threat from al-Qaeda metastasized, Kappus, Lavoie, and other Pakistan specialists believed. They recognized that the United States had conflicting interests with Pakistan, but argued that Washington would get further toward its goals through engagement. On the other side of the debate, CIA officers such as Chris Wood argued that Washington had not gone far enough to pressure ISI during the 1990s or after September 11th. Wood and his allies believed that if ISI did not stop tolerating and supporting the Taliban, the United States should threaten to impose sanctions that would stigmatize senior Pakistani generals, restricting their travel or personal access to international banking, as if they were equivalent to Sudanese war criminals or North Korean totalitarians. Wood argued that generals like Kayani so valued their legitimacy, travel, and freedom to bank and send children to universities abroad that they would bend to such pressure before sanctions ever had to be imposed. When he spoke privately to Kayani about the turn in American policy after the summer of 2008, Kappus tried to talk as one professional intelligence officer to another. To Kappus, engagement was the essence of intelligence work. Without contact and continuous discussion, there was no chance to influence behavior. Kappus warned that if the CIA located Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri hiding on Pakistani soil, the agency would recommend direct action inside Pakistan and that any American president would likely order an attack. There would inevitably be frictions. He emphasized that the CIA prided itself on never closing a communications channel. Kayani could always contact Langley if he wanted to get a message through to the White House, no matter how bad things got. Kappus and Admiral Mike Mullen sweetened this tough messaging with new offers. What new military or counterterrorism equipment did Kayani need as he reevaluated the Pakistan Army? What was on his wish list? Could the United States and Pakistan restart a conversation at the highest levels about strategy and about how the United States might help Kayani modernize Pakistan's forces? In the long history of schizophrenia involving Washington and Rawalpindi, a new chapter had opened. That summer, Senator Barack Obama landed at Bagram Airfield. The presumptive Democratic presidential nominee was on a tour of the wars he might inherit in Iraq and Afghanistan. He traveled with Senators Jack Reed of Rhode Island and Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, both military veterans. At Bagram, Obama spoke to troops and posed for selfies. Helicopters lifted the three senators to an American base in Jalalabad. Leading the Afghan delegation to greet Obama was Gul Aga Sherzai, the dogfighter's son who had returned to power with CIA backing after the Taliban's fall. Following his dystopian tour as Kandahar's governor, he had moved on to become the governor of Nangarhar province, an important and relatively prosperous region near Pakistan. This day, the governor wore a striped western shirt over his large, soft belly and sported a trimmed black beard. Obama pumped Sherzai's hand warmly and put his hand around his shoulder. At a hollow square table, across from American generals and colonels in camouflage uniform, Sherzai occupied the place of honor to Obama's right and held forth about his accomplishments in eastern Afghanistan. Why the U.S. Embassy in Kabul would select Sherzai as Obama's huggable first interlocutor in Afghanistan was a mystery some of Obama's aides would puzzle over in the years ahead. Among other things, the decision insulted Hamid Karzai before Obama had ever met him by elevating a rival and subordinate ahead of the Afghan president in highly visible protocol. Obama was new to Afghanistan, but he had personal connections to Pakistan. As a college sophomore in Los Angeles, he had shared an apartment with a Pakistani friend, Hassan Chandu, a business-minded Shiite from a prosperous Karachi family. Obama visited Pakistan with Chandu and made other Pakistani friends as he came of age and later entered Harvard Law School. Years later, this small Pakistani-American network helped raise some money for Obama's political campaigns in Illinois and celebrated him in Washington when he reached the United States Senate in 2004. These friends provided Obama with informal insights about Pakistan. Gul Aga Sherzai might be familiar in that he resembled a Chicago ward boss of the Prohibition era, but the local mysteries of tribe, profiteering, land-grabbing, and influence-peddling the governor presided over from Jalalabad were opaque even to the Americans who studied him up close. All Obama could really hope for, as he prepared for the possibility of command of the Afghan war, was an instinctual sense of direction. Hamid Karzai received Obama for a working lunch at the Arg Palace the next day. Amrullah Saleh of NDS joined the discussion, as did other members of the National Security Cabinet. Karzai's war advisors did not always work coherently, but this time they and their president had settled on a firm plan. They would seize this opportunity to try to educate Barack Obama about the treachery of ISI. Saleh saw the coming Kayani era in Pakistan ominously. Saleh told American counterparts in 2008 that General Kayani would become more active as he realizes the breadth of his power as Army Chief, and that he would encourage the Taliban and allied radicals to concentrate on fighting in Afghanistan for as long as possible while the Army tried to restore order at home. At lunch, Karzai described Pakistan as a source of increasing instability in Afghanistan. His remedy included U.S. military operations in Pakistan. Pakistan's civilian leaders, such as the late Benazir Bhutto and Asif Zardari, had good intentions, Karzai emphasized, but the problem was ISI and the Pakistani military. Chuck Hagel asked if Zardari could control the army and ISI. No, not without the help of the U.S., Karzai said. The United States had to insist that Pakistan stop using radical Islam as an instrument of policy and issue an ultimatum as Bush had done in 2001, namely, that Pakistan choose whether it was with the United States or against it. Softly, softly won't work, Karzai said. Obama asked if Zardari's problem was a lack of capacity. The problem is ISI, Karzai repeated, which runs the country. Obama already knew enough to take Pakistan blaming by Afghan officials with a grain of salt. He told Karzai that the United States was committed to his country for the long run, but that U.S. support would be much more durable if Afghans started taking credible action on drugs and corruption. Obviously, too, the Taliban's message was getting through to Afghans, regardless of Pakistan's covert warfare. Were Afghans susceptible to Islamist messages? Obama asked gently. Karzai insisted that without Pakistan's intervention, the Taliban message would never have influenced Afghans. Over three decades, thousands of Afghan boys were indoctrinated into hatefulness disguised as Islam. The Taliban were now killing off older Afghan clergy and replacing them with younger, Pakistani-trained mullahs. We still have a lot of work to do, Obama noted. By 2008, evidence to support the CIA's assessment that al-Qaeda was fusing with the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban in the federally administered tribal areas was openly available on YouTube. The digital, laptop-enabled output of al-Qaeda's media arm in Pakistan, As Sahab, surged. Between 2002 and 2005, al-Qaeda released messages or videos once a month. Between 2006 and 2008, it released fresh content more than once a week. Its videos, war documentaries, and digital magazines were diverse and global in concern, but they bore down increasingly on the cause of the American war in Afghanistan. Mustafa Abu al-Yazid, a then 52-year-old Egyptian with a thin, long face, had been convicted as a young man in the successful conspiracy to assassinate Anwar Sadat, and had gone into exile with Ayman al-Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda deputy emir. In 2007, he emerged as a spokesman for al-Qaeda's commitment to the Afghan cause. He called himself the leader of al-Qaeda in Khorasan and Afghanistan, a name referring to historical territory overlapping with Afghanistan and Pakistan, under Mullah Omar, who remained at large and recognized as the Taliban emir. Yazid's exact rank in the al-Qaeda hierarchy was hard to specify, but he was the latest in a succession of visible senior frontline commanders just below Zawahiri, and he evidently operated from Waziristan. In June 2008, a Toyota bearing Pakistan-issued diplomatic plates blew up in front of the Danish embassy in Islamabad, killing about half a dozen Pakistanis. Yazid surfaced through As Sahab to claim responsibility, saying the attack was revenge for the cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad published the previous winter in a Danish newspaper. The Egyptian felt secure enough the following month to invite a reporter from Pakistan's freewheeling independent satellite channel, GEO, to interview him. Yazid wore a white turban and owlish plastic-framed eyeglasses. The U.S. claims that it has successfully occupied Afghanistan and brought the resistance under control, the GEO reporter observed. That is a total lie, Yazid said mildly. Within the limits of Islamist propaganda idioms, he spoke crisply and coherently. By the grace of Allah, the killing of U.S. soldiers is continuing, and the Mujahideen are fighting against the Americans and their slaves with steadfastness, he continued. The United States had tried to assemble some tribal militias and use them against the Mujahideen, he observed, apparently referring to the CIA's Omega border units. And their failure in Afghanistan is even more evident. The proof of this is after every few days they hold an emergency meeting of NATO and request each other with great pleading to increase their forces in Afghanistan. But very few are ready for this great sacrifice. He added that of all the compromised Muslim regimes in the world, none had more betrayed the Muslim faith than Pakistan under Pervez Musharraf. Because the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan did have common enemies, the Americans persisted in the belief that Kayani and the army would make common cause with Washington. But the closer Kayani moved Pakistan toward the United States, the more it brought violence down on his country from al-Qaeda and its allies. The CIA's plan to step up its war in the tribal areas had two prongs, more drone strikes and more direct special operations raids by helicopter against al-Qaeda and affiliated compounds on Pakistani territory. A few weeks after Yazid's interview with GEO, on August 28th, Bush's National Security Council met to authorize a ground strike in Angur Ada in South Waziristan, a town of ramshackle shops and bus depots that lay across a flat mud plain from Shkin, the long-standing site of a joint CIA special operations base. Uzbeks and other foreigners still infested the region. Around 2 a.m. on September 3rd, Navy SEALs borne by Chinook helicopters, flanked by Apache attack helicopters, struck three homes in Musa Nika near Angur Ada. 10 local tribesmen, 190 years old, 5 women and 2 children died in the firefight. A man from one of the targeted families drove a taxi and had recently carried an Arab passenger. The local assumption was that an informant had told the Americans that a senior al-Qaeda leader was staying at his house. The Pentagon insisted that all the victims were militants, but a Pakistani brigadier serving in South Waziristan later published a convincing roster of the women and children he said had died. Kayani dispatched Foreign Secretary Salman Bashir to inform U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson that Pakistan would issue a statement denouncing the strike, but, as a courtesy, would not name the United States as the culprit. Bashir was a circumspect professional diplomat. He told Patterson that bilateral intelligence and military cooperation was good overall, but that this raid had occurred without regard to the high-level understanding between the two military commands that Pakistan would be taken into confidence about covert action on its soil. A week later, the New York Times reported what few beyond Kayani understood. The attack was a signal of the increased willingness of the United States to take unilateral action inside Pakistan. President Bush had directly approved the raid. Kayani issued an unusual statement declaring that the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the country would be defended at all costs, and no external force is allowed to conduct operations inside Pakistan. An army spokesman added that if it happened again, Pakistan would retaliate against the attacking force. Twin headlines in the Daily News captured the Army's public ultimatum. Boots on the ground, Bush, and No Way, Kayani. The White House and Special Operations Command had overreached, but Al-Qaeda was becoming even bolder. On September 20th, 2008, a Pakistani citizen drove a dump truck onto the grounds of the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, a center of international diplomatic and expatriate life in the capital. The truck carried perhaps six times the explosive load of the car bomb deployed against the Indian embassy in July. The detonation and fire that followed killed 54 people, the great majority of them Pakistanis, and injured more than 200 others. Two Americans died, one a Navy cryptologist on assignment in Pakistan for the National Security Agency. The attack allegedly was the brainchild of a Kenyan al-Qaeda operator who used the nom de guerre Usama al-Kani and who had been indicted in al-Qaeda's 1998 embassy bombings in Africa. Al-Qaeda celebrated, but killing privileged Pakistani civilians en masse was a miscalculation. It hardened Pakistani and media opinion against foreign terrorists and the Taliban, as well as against the United States. Kappas and Mullen flew back to Islamabad to again press their request for ISI reform on Kayani. The CIA had drawn up and vetted with the White House a list of concrete steps the general could take to demonstrate that he was sincere about cleaning up ISI. Kappas conveyed that he was speaking for President Bush. One proposed step was to appoint more reliable officers to run ISI and Directorate S. The protocol in such messaging was to leave out the names of individuals, but the implication was clear. Kayani should fire Nadeem Taj and remove Asif Akhtar from Directorate S. Kayani assured them he planned to act. To minimize embarrassment, he would reveal a shakeup at ISI as part of a regular announcement about promotions, reassignments, and up or out forced retirements. Kayani had his own motivations. Moving Musharraf's bagman out of ISI would allow him to appoint a successor loyal to him. On September 29th, Kayani announced that Taj would rotate to a division command. Asif Akhtar rotated from Directorate S and was assigned to the National Guard. He soon became Pakistan's ambassador to Nigeria. As to the rest of Kappas's confidence-building proposals, which included demonstrative steps to break ties with Taliban and Kashmiri militants, Kayani was noncommittal. The Islamabad embassy nonetheless remained optimistic. Kayani has taken a critical first step, it reported. Kayani had made his objections to American helicopter raids inside Pakistan crystal clear. Kappas made equally clear that the United States intended to attack al-Qaeda directly with armed drones, given that the Pakistan Army was unable, or unwilling, or both, to clear out North Waziristan. These positions did not preclude cooperation on some shared interests. Kayani indicated that summer and autumn that he wanted Baitullah Masood dead. In this, the general had the full support of the civilian government of the Pakistan People's Party. They held Massoud at least partly responsible for Benazir Bhutto's assassination, along with the Pakistani security services. The targeting discussions did not change the fact that Pakistan still distinguished between good militants and bad militants, however. It was